And that was ELO with, what was that again?
I can't get it out of my head.
I can't get it out of my head with a long intro. Very interesting. Brings back memories. And we're going to switch it up now from Ear Buddies to Socialist Alternative Radio. Talking music from a working class, democratic socialist perspective. And you are listening to WMFO Medford. That's WMFO in Medford. Also known by many cool names, Tufts Educational Radio. Good night. Bye. Good night. Yeah. Bye. I'm saying good night. It's 11 a.m. here, Eastern Standard Time, for our international or national listeners. And we're emanating from Tufts University there at the border of Somerville, Massachusetts, and Medford, Massachusetts, two densely populated exurbs of Boston, Massachusetts, United States of America, planet Earth, and all that stuff. So, yeah, Tufts Educational Radio, Tufts Freeform Commercial Free Community Based Radio. We're a little slice of that community base. And by the way, commercial free. I'm loving commercial free. Somehow my wife, Tina, managed to get us some free Netflix time. I've never been on Netflix before, right? I'm just loving the non-commercial aspect of most of Netflix. There's a way to, I don't understand the technology, there's a way to get on to other stations that have other, that do still have limited commercials, but I like to just know commercial things so much, you know. So I'm still into DVDs and stuff, and anything without commercials on it, I'm into. And then you know, and you think you're escaping it, but yesterday I'm pumping gas, and a lot of gas stations now have little TVs on the gas pumps. I mean, do you despise that as much as I do? Because you know, raise your hands, and we'll take a count. Because man, my hand is up. I hate that stuff. I don't want to pump gas and watch ads or fake news or whatever. And I don't mean fake news, Donald Trump fake news. I mean, well, yeah, actually, like Donald Trump. Donald Trump is full of fake news. But anyway, it's just, you know, come on, give us a break. We don't need to be advertised at everywhere. I guess it's related to the Facebook scandal, but you don't hear much about that angle on the Facebook thing. You know, like, this is all engineered by the need to generate profits in something that really has no inherent profit-making capability except through advertising and maybe, you know, charging for things that should be free, which is, you know, really part of the standard sort of capitalist problem. One of the main dilemmas or chronic problems of capitalism is that it's always trying to, you know, short-term maximization of profit is the god of capitalism. It's always trying to make more profits regardless of human need. You know, there is an intersection between some human somewhere or humans that see a use value or see a use for the thing, the commodity being produced, and will pay something for it once the commodity hits the market. But the capitalists can just produce purely useless garbage that's never going to sell, and they often do. It's an incredibly wasteful system. But it's also a system that's always trying to find new things to charge money for, to put it simply. So you have, for example, the CEO of Nestle's, who's, they're buying up water all over the place, water sources and water companies, so to speak. And humans need water. I'm sorry. You know, I mean, whether you can pay for it or not, you deserve water. Okay, water, where bodies are made of water, we need water, et cetera, et cetera. So what you have is basically Nestle, the CEO of Nestle basically saying, nah, water's not a right. Water's a commodity. We're charging for water, and water should cost money all the time. You know, and I'm not just talking about bottled water. If you're cognizant, if you're aware or an adult or whatever, you realize that you're paying, most people in America are paying huge amounts of money for local water bills. I'm paying a crippling amount where I live, or my wife and I are paying a crippling amount where we live. You have people paying crippling amounts for clean water by buying bottled water, or, you know, because their water source isn't good. And, you know, a lot of sort of people that try to organize through a very comfortable position as a member of the upper middle class or upper class, bourgeois, ruling class, they like to lecture people about, just don't buy bottled water, you know? Well, if the water coming out of my tap is poisonous and filled with lead, I sure am going to buy bottled water, hoping that it's a little better, you know, might not be, but hoping it's better. I mean, we're working class people, and by that I mean a very broad definition of working class, you know, mostly women, encompassing all gender and racial categories that have been foisted upon us by that kind of false categorization of humanity. But you know, racial, ethnic, gender categories, all inclusive in the working class. It's not just a cliched version of the working class. Anyone that has to sell their labor to survive, even if they're making a high wage, if they can't just quit that job and live comfortably the rest of their lives through some sort of inheritance or something, then they're still working class, you know. Even if they're going to make the bolt at some point and try to open a business or something, they're still working class as long as they have to sell that labor or try, and successfully or unsuccessfully. By the way, is it bothering everyone as much as it is me, this full employment stuff you hear all the time? Just as a matter of course now, the corporate media just says it's full employment here in the United States. Well, it's not full employment. I know people that are unemployed, okay? People that have skills and so on, and even if they didn't, whatever, they could be trained and for new skills or whatever. And no, people are unemployed. Yeah, people are unemployed. You still have to go through humiliating, idiotic job interviews to get a job. You still have corporations deliberately, and small businesses deliberately, creating a part-time, precarious, contingent workforce through only hiring part-time, through not having set schedules, through paying minimum wage or just above minimum wage. And so, for example, in the Boston area where we're broadcasting from, you see a lot of signs for jobs that in other places would be strictly minimum wage, and they're above minimum wage. But in the context of this cost of living in Boston, they are still minimum wage or below minimum wage when you factor in the costs of everything, from housing to just basic food to transportation. You know, everything, all the problems that sort of the macro problems, but even a lot of the individual problems that we face in this system are rooted in the capitalist system, that we face under the system are rooted in the capitalist system. So, for example, things to do with getting a decent job and why there isn't actually full employment, you know, are often related to things like transportation too expensive. I can't afford a car. I can't afford to call Lyft, of course, or Uber or whatever. I can't afford to ride public transportation, which is really expensive around here now. I mean, you can if I go one subway stop, which I, based on where I work and where I need to go sometimes for work, actually, sometimes they don't pay my subway to go to a meeting off away from where I work. It would cost me $5 round trip for one subway stop, you know, for about a mile or less. And I hear you say, why don't you just walk it? Well, I don't have time to walk it because I'm in the middle of a work day and I don't have time to give up 40 minutes or more walking it, when I'm supposed to be working or when I'm supposed to be picking up my kids or something like that, you know? So, and by the way, whenever you hear that little voice in your head that says, why don't you just do this or that instead to cope with an unfair situation that could be changed easily in a way, just check that voice. That is the voice of internalizing the repression of capitalism. That is the voice of internalizing the repression that working people face all the time under the capitalist system. So everybody's got their personal survival strategies. Don't be proud of them. Don't be proud of them at all. Don't try to foist them on other people. Everyone's experiences are slightly different. They might not have the money or the energy to do what you think is a little trick to beat the system. And guess what? Everyone that always brags to me about that, their individual survival strategies, I see them fall apart. I see those strategies just fall apart. You know, I see their expectations lower to the point of, you know, abject, you know, paycheck to paycheck survival, and wonder, why do you think you're doing so well with your little survival strategy of like bringing your lunch into work every day or something, you know, when your life sucks, basically. And you tell me your life sucks. I'm not making a judgment. I'm just saying, you tell me that, you know. And then the next breath, you're like, yeah, why doesn't so-and-so bring in their lunch? What are they going out to eat and wasting all that money and so on? So yeah, some people, they have to do things to save time that cost money. That's the constant dilemma working class people are facing. some time and money. So you spend money to spend more time with your kids. Now, one of the worst examples I've heard of that, there was someone on the radio the other day, I think it was on National Propaganda Radio, saying to working people, or saying to people in general, they don't really make class distinctions, of course. Officially, there is no social class in the United States. But there was somebody on the radio the other day saying, in order to spend more time with your children, with your family, why not have somebody... Oh, no, I'm sorry. Here, let's back it up. Here's the context. Many divorces are traced to arguments, to disagreements over housework and getting housework done, right? Laundry, cleaning, cooking, all the stuff you need to keep things going, right? Repairs, whatever. And so a lot of divorces are apparently... traced to disagreements over these, over the amount of work and how to get it done and who does what, you know, the division of labor not working so well because people are so stressed with jobs, commutes, if they have them. A lot of people do jobs, commutes, most people do, childcare, etc. And so this was the advice from the show. This is what is so pathetic about the corporate media. They can't think beyond the parameters of capitalism. So they're not allowed to, even if they do, if some of them do, you know, your editor will take care of that. But this is crazy talk, taxing the super rich and big corporations to fund, to open more schools, to fund childcare. No, this is crazy. What are you, what are we, advocacy radio? We are perfectly non-biased here in corporate media land because we only say what the capitalists want to hear. And that makes us perfectly non-biased. We are completely non-ideological because we don't use the word capitalism and we ignore social class and we only say what the Koch brothers and others want us to say because they give us the money. But we're non-biased, you know? So anyway, getting back to the story, the advice was, have someone come in. Have someone do your housework. Have someone do your landscaping. And then you'll be able to spend more time with your family. And this will be a really worthy investment. Because, and I'm sitting there, you know, wanting to just drive off the road and shout at the radio and pound the radio to smithereens. Because who can afford a housekeeper? Who can afford landscaping? I mean, who can afford that? I mean, I know people are working, some people are working that in, especially elderly people have to, you know, get someone in to help with it. But it's expensive. I mean, it's a huge expense and it's a hard, difficult expense that many, many, many millions of people just can't afford. I mean, it's bad enough. Childcare in the United States is completely left to people paying for it. You know, it's extremely expensive. So you're probably, if you have children, you're spending your money on daycare centers or babysitters. And that's just an incredible expense. And on top of it, you're gonna have someone come in and clean and do this. Come on. This is like, there's such a disconnect between the ruling class and the ruling ideas of this country in the United States and worldwide. I mean, I've been to other countries as well. It's the same thing, in the capitalist countries. And it's just like, there's no reality going on, very little reality going on in the corporate media. And lately, because of, I think there's a correlation between cutbacks that have happened in the corporate media to the fact that you don't even get like the throwaway line or two about how horrible, say, the general strikes are in France in the context of corporate media capitalist thinking. You know, they just don't talk about them. Like, there's been these big strikes in France recently, a wave of them against the Thatcherite, Reaganite government of Macron, M-A-C-R-O-N, a new bourgeois leader there. And this guy got elected out of a familiar, this will sound familiar to the American listeners of this show, a sort of lesser evilist vote between, you know, they wanted to make sure that this far right party, Front National, the Le Pen party, didn't get more votes. So they voted for, so a lot of people voted for Macron, even though there was a very good left-wing candidate named Mélenchon. And a sort of, I think it was left, part is called Left Unity or something. I have to research that. But anyway, so Macron gets elected explicitly, you know, saying more or less he was going to do the whole, I mean, there was an element of populism and lying in his campaign, but there was also, of course, in the way he framed things, or they framed things for him. But you could see it coming down if you were half awake that this guy was going to be another Thatcher, you know, and he was going to just really cut, you know, social spending and attack the unions and just make life miserable or more miserable for working people in France. And so but in France, there's a certain level of organization through the unions and through left political parties, and a tradition of struggle in that country for socialism. And so there's a fight back happening. Do you hear a word about it in the corporate media here? I mean, I haven't heard anything about it here. And it's a very important struggle, very interesting struggle. So we are going to take a very short break and come back with announcements, sort of news, yeah, about an upcoming meeting on the wave of strikes that's happening with teachers and other upturns in the labor movement here in the United States, in this area in particular, and around the Boston area. And we're going to also talk about the Kentucky teachers strike, a little bit about why unions are important. And there's a new issue of Socialist Alternative newspaper. And by the way, if you want more new information about Socialist Alternative, go to socialistalternative.org. If you want more information about this show, go to Facebook, go to Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook. We post a lot of new stuff, and it's sometimes interesting comments and stuff and chat on the Facebook page. It's not just advertising the show. It's a real thing where we post a lot of things similar to what we talk about on the show, anti-capitalism, socialist organizing, inequality and anti-racist work, the women's movement aspects of the women's movement that's growing around the country in certain ways, but right now we have to go fill out a little form. And we're going to just come out with a song we've played on the air before by Leonard Cohen, and maybe you know it.
When they poured across the border, I was cautioned to surrender. This I could not do. I took my gun and vanished. I have changed my name so often. I've lost my wife and children, but I've many friends, and some of them are with me. An old woman gave us shelter, kept us hidden in the garret. Then the soldiers came. She died without a whisper. There were three of us this morning. I'm the only one this evening, but I must go on. The frontiers are my prison. Oh, the wind is blowing. Through the graves the wind is blowing. Freedom soon will come. Then we'll come from shadow. Mais je n'ai pas peur. Thank you. the wind is blowing. Through the graves, the wind is blowing. Freedom soon will come. Then we'll come from the shadow.
That was Leonard Cohen with Partisan, or The Partisan, from The Essential Leonard Cohen. And that's a really interesting and beautiful song that talks about resistance to the Nazis in France. And he has a political side, I think, a progressive political side, at least. Also, that song you may have known from him called Everybody Knows, I think, has elements of that. And there's others as well. And we are back with, you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And we are, an activist, a member of Socialist Alternative, I wanted to talk about an upcoming public meeting hosted by Worcester Socialist Alternative. Now, Worcester is, for those not from the area listening, it's a city about 45 minutes away from Boston in the middle of Massachusetts. There are a certain number of people that commute from Worcester every day to Boston or during the weekday work days to work because rents tend to be cheaper out in Worcester, although they're going up. Housing is becoming entering into a crisis situation out in Worcester as well as just about everywhere else in the United States. And we are sponsoring a meeting on the West Virginia teacher strike and labor struggles in Worcester. W-O-R-C-E-S-T-E-R, by the way, is the spelling of Worcester, which is pronounced Wusta around here, or Wusta, or I've heard the variations. This is a public meeting hosted by Worcester Socialist Alternative. It's Thursday, April 12th, 6 p.m. in the Blue Lounge, the Student Center at Worcester State University. Tanya Whitworth, a socialist teacher and labor activist, will be speaking. She's also a member of the union UAW Local 2322, which is the grad students union at UMass Amherst, and that is actually the oldest grad students union in the country. And recently, Tanya's been involved in working on the campaign team with Ginger Jensen, an independent social candidate for Minneapolis City Council, and other organizing in Worcester and around the UMass Amherst area, and she'll be speaking about the West Virginia teacher strike, the other teacher strikes that have been happening after the success and victory of the West Virginia teacher strike, which we'll be talking about, but also union struggles happening in Worcester itself. The Carpenters Union, for example, is fighting for, against wage theft and other problems with a non-union work site, a big work site in Worcester. The Amalgamated Transit Workers Union Local 22, that's part of a national union, as is the Carpenters Union, by the way, but Local 22 of ATU, a union in Worcester of primarily bus drivers in the city bus system, which a lot of people use and depend on. There's a high rate of poverty in Worcester, and a lot of immigrant workers living in Worcester, and the bus system is well used, and yet the city and state continue to cut funding to the bus operations in Worcester and other cities, and that results in cutbacks in routes, cutbacks, layoffs of workers, and so on. So there should be a representative. We've been promised a representative of ATU, Local 22, would be at the meeting to talk about that in more detail. It's a winnable situation in Worcester because there's only like $1 million shortfall in the budget, and $1 million is really chump change when it comes to state budget in Massachusetts. They have a rainy day fund of, I forget, tens of millions at least, maybe hundreds of millions, but I will say safely tens of millions. They could just pick a little bit off of and fully fund this situation. Even the city has the money. But as is happening all across the United States, whether it's Democrats in power or Republicans in power in local areas, there's this. You're told on the one hand from the corporate media that the economy is booming, that we're in, like I was saying earlier, this full employment myth and everything else. But when it comes to city budgets, somehow there's no money, right? So big business is making, the corporations are making record profits, but there's no money. The rich are, literally, if you look at statistics, the number of rich people in the United States is increasing. At the same time, the number of people getting poorer is increasing. So inequality as a whole is increasing and getting worse. But we're told that those people that are getting richer, the super rich that primarily own the corporations, they can't be taxed more. You can't do it. I mean, it's not even talked about in a lot of places. And you can't, of course, tax big business. In fact, they've had their taxes just cut by the national tax cut bill that the Trump administration rammed through. So, but even in local areas, you have Democrats. It's not just Trump. If it was just Trump, that would be easy. But you have Democrats, unfortunately, but typically, basically doing what they usually do and defending the interests of the corporations in the local areas. So every city you go to in the United States, there's austerity happening. There's these deep-rooted problems that seem intractable. Oh, we have to every year look at the school budget anew, and maybe we raised a little bit this year, but next year we're gonna close schools and we're gonna have more crowded classrooms, and there's just enough money for this or that. I mean, these teachers are going on strike in West Virginia and Kentucky because it should reach rock bottom. The conditions are just so horrible, and you know, in many cities, some of the problems on the surface are, I mean, under capitalism, you can't solve any of these problems, but under capitalism, you can temporarily ameliorate these problems if there's a mass movement against these problems and against capitalism. Actually, that helps to infuse any movement with staying power to connect the dots between the system and the problem. But the money is there. The super rich are sitting on masses of money. In fact, if you look at statistics about and analyses of investment right now. Investment's a nice, cute word for capitalists spreading their power and exploitation. They are sitting on a lot of money that they don't quite know where to invest. There were other times in U.S. history where it was easy. You know, you stick your money in a bank with high interest rates. You buy bonds. You do all sorts of things in the financial sector to make more money. And that's still happening. Of course, there's speculation in the financial sector, currency trading and stock trading and so on. That's always there. But even with that outlet, so to speak, there's still a lot of money that the capitalists aren't sure, you know, where do we put the money to get maximum short-term profit, maximum profit rate increase in the short term, the god again of capitalism. They're confused about where to do that, because there's countervailing tendencies of, like, you know, for example, retail, where the retail stores are closing in a lot of places. There's things that look like, you know, a profitable investment, but they're already valued very high, quote unquote, using stock market jargon. So what's the return going to be there, you know? So they're sitting on a lot of cash, is what I'm trying to say. They have been for, I think it's over a decade that people have been analyzing this. They're sitting on a lot of cash. It started, you know, somewhat around the Great Recession, so-called 2007-2008, where things kind of contracted back to the assets and cash you had. And credit was problematic for especially, you know, working people in small businesses, but also even some big businesses. They got that big corporate bailout. They got that big government bailout. Sorry, they went to the big corporations, created more liquidity, quote unquote, more cash floating around, and a lot of profits being held onto and converted into cash assets and so on. A lot of acquisitions and mergers that are always happening, but intensified at certain times. And that was true after the so-called Great Recession within the last decade, that can create more assets and more cash, depending on what they decide to do with the newly acquired companies. But lately, like, it has been just sitting on those assets and liquidating things for cash, liquidating operations for cash, and so on. So sitting on mounds of cash, not sure where to invest, but we're told there's no money for things that these businesses depend on. They absolutely depend on infrastructure, transportation, and so on. They absolutely depend on getting as much training done before they hire someone. Businesses are always crying about especially now, that the workforce isn't trained enough. Well, what they mean by that is that they're no longer willing, like they were in sometimes in the past when they were forced to by regulation and so on. They're no longer willing to train people. You know, they're no longer willing to really invest in training. They want it to be a DIY culture now. Do it yourself. Come on in. Be a little anarchist for capitalism, you know, and just do everything yourself, and then we'll swoop in and, of course, get all the value that you add and turn it into profit, and keep the profit for ourselves and say there's no money. There's no money. There's no money. What they, you know, as a lot of people realize or that have studied this, you know, tax rates, for example, during the last, one of the last record levels of profit making, may perhaps the quintessential time for big business, the biggest profit making time, because the prolonged post-war upswing in the United States of 1950 around 1974-75, you had tax rates in the 50s, say under the Eisenhower administration, of 90% under of personal income. You had tax rates of corporations that were increasing drastically. If you look at the history closely, it's very interesting history. You had the Democrats like Kennedy and later Carter and others, Clinton, of course, cutting taxes for the super rich and the big corporations, and leading to the point where they were where the personal tax rate is just you know, very, very low. The effective tax rate on corporations, extremely low. Now even it's going to be even lower. Even before the Trump tax cuts, where on paper it was a 34% tax rate. I'm sorry, in big corporations, which was not the highest in the world, by the way, and not a problem at all. It should have been more than that, a lot more. Instead, the Democrats bought into that. You know, they opposed Trump's tax bill as a whole, but they didn't make much noise about the corporate tax rate. They even said publicly, a lot of them, well, we kind of agree with that, but the question of how much and blah, blah. So, but even during all that blah, blah, all that talk, all that blather, all that propaganda, where both corporate parties were agreeing to tax cuts on the big corporations, which is obscene when you think about it, just crazy, that before that and during that, the effective tax rate, what they actually collected from these big corporations, was down to like 18%, 17%. You know, I mean, I mentioned earlier we have a new issue of Socialist Alternatives newspaper out there, headline, by the way, Rebuild a Fighting Labor Movement Mobilized to Defeat Janus, which is the Supreme Court ruling coming up to push to make unions weaker. There is also an article here called Amazon, and I mentioned this, I think, the last show. Amazon pays $0 in taxes in 2017. Subhead, we need public ownership of key corporations. Oh, we do. We need public ownership of the top 500 corporations. And that's how the article basically ends. It says, quote, the dog-eat-dog logic of capitalism rewards the most voracious business practices. Jeff Bezos and Amazon are demonstrating why Social Alternative calls for the public ownership of the top 500 major banks and corporations, and for them to be run by working-class people in the interest of working-class communities and as part of a democratic socialist economy, and I would add, on a world scale. So that is what's going on now. We're told there's no money for bus drivers in Worcester. There's no money for teachers in West Virginia or Kentucky or whatever. There's so much money available. Now, again, I'm not saying that getting all the money in that could be gotten into budgets now to have free health care, free education, free child care, free elder care, all those resources exist under capitalism. The thing is that to get them is the class struggle. That is the class struggle. That is the war. That is a civil war between social classes, the working class and the ruling class, the bourgeois, the big business class, corporate leaders, whatever you want to call it, class. And their political bought and paid for political parties, Democrats and Republicans. So to fight for that, the resources that would at least temporarily ameliorate the situation, I mean, capitalism will come back around like they did after the post-war upswing, when a lot of social welfare provisions and reforms and changes for the better for working class people that were done in a lot of the advanced capitalist countries. Take, for example, the Scandinavian thing. You know, everyone thinks that's socialism. It never was socialism. It is not socialism. But they had a higher rate of unionization. They had workers' parties, not just a liberal and a conservative party, so-called, but they had workers' parties, socialist, communist, labor parties. They won tremendous gains in social welfare, but there was still poverty at the end of the day, and there shouldn't have been. there was still a lot of the gains made were on the backs of the imperialism, the power that was exerted internationally by the big corporations in the advanced capitalist countries, extracting wealth from the underdeveloped countries around the world. And so it was built on a house of cards, so to speak. The capitalists themselves weren't giving up the means of production. They were basically just getting money here or there, making some concessions, raising taxes, unfortunately, on working people to pay for a lot of that stuff. But you know, there was a serious, you know, relative to now, a higher tax rate on rich individuals and on the big corporations in many, many countries, including the United States. And then starting around the early 70s, especially with the 74-75 recession, the counteroffensive began, which is inevitable. Always a counteroffensive. That's my point here. Always a counteroffensive begins to claw back any little bit that we get, as workers, that we any of our, you know, profit is basically, all profits are basically the unpaid wages of the working class, meaning you cannot create a commodity without workers. And the workers then, even if it's, you want to say robots, well, someone built the robots, et cetera, someone maintains them, you know, there's always workers involved, whether they, whether we're told they're not really there or not. And so, in fact, there was just this thing on the radio. I really wanted to get this, this book, or, someone just wrote a book about how, the idea in our minds planted by the corporate media and by big business is that, things just get created magically now. 3D printing, automation, and deindustrialization, blah, blah, blah. When in actuality, in reality, on a world scale, I'm not talking about like the gentrified inner cities of some places in the United States. I'm talking about on a world scale, and including some places in the United States, manufacturing is employing more people than ever, with more people in the history of capitalism, with more people in bigger labor intensively concentrated working places and factories and industries than ever before. It's just a question of where you look. It's just a question of what you choose to ignore. And, you know, but we're convinced, you know, there's just no industry anymore. Well, there's tons, there's more industry than ever before. It's just not, in many cases, in the places where it started. You know, but even there, if you look carefully, even in a place that you think is devoid of industry, if you look carefully, there's a lot of industry, relatively speaking. There isn't as much as there used to be, but there's still a lot. Like, for example, in the United States. But if you go world scale, if you go worldwide, there's huge, huge amounts of factories that are anything but totally automated, that have tons of workers. This guy was quoting workplaces of 200,000, factory complexes of 200,000, one industry, one factory, one company, 200,000 workers. I really wanted to get that book, and I will look for it. But you know, we're told there's no money for things, whereas there's huge profits going on, huge industry going on, huge waste of money in financial speculation and so on. But they can't find enough to keep schools open, to keep buses running, to keep decent, to have decent in the United States, to have decent health care. There's still record bankruptcies in the United States. The main reason for bankruptcy is paying for health care. That's whether or not you have insurance. If you have insurance, the insurance won't cover a lot of stuff. If you don't have insurance, obviously a lot of stuff won't be covered as well. And either way, you're screwed. You know, Michael Moore did that movie Sicko back in the 90s that showed that really well. And that has not changed, even with Obamacare, that has not changed. Record number of bankruptcies. Well, I'm not sure about record number of bankruptcies, but bankruptcies, the main reason for bankruptcies is still medical costs in the United States, the richest country in the world. But there's no money for, you know, single-payer, socialized medicine, whatever you want to call it, national health. I mean, they're all slightly different, but the universal health care provisions that could be enacted that have been, you know, in fits and starts, warts and all, in other countries. But just one more mention again, a public meeting hosted by Worcester Socialist Alternative, West Virginia teacher strike and labor struggles in Worcester, and other teacher strikes will be talked about by a teacher, Kanye Whitworth, a socialist labor activist, will be speaking Thursday, April 12th, 6 p.m., Blue Lounge Student Center, Worcester State University. For more info, you can email worcestersa@gmail.com. You can call 508-864-5006. you may have heard, if you're from the Boston area, this made a little bit of press, which was good, actually. I was happy to see that. A little bit of corporate media time, a few seconds here and there, a few hundred words here and there. That here at, and by here, I mean this radio station emanates from Tufts University. And the dining hall workers at Tufts are organizing their union. And they're going with an already existing union called Unite Here Local 26. And that is a union that represents dining hall workers at Northeastern University, at Harvard University, and many other places, and represents hotel workers and so on. And in fact, in 2016, there was a strike at Harvard that we've talked about on the show. That was absolutely brilliant. It was a very well-attended strike, so to speak, like a lot of workers involved, most, maybe all the workers involved in picketing and protesting enough that Harvard just couldn't stand it. You know, and there are a lot of companies that their public profile is so important to them. You know, they want donations, they want favorable treatment from the city, from the state, and so on. And even a huge entity like Harvard University, the richest university in the world, had a vulnerable spot for just too much bad publicity for exploiting the heck out of these dining hall workers. And I know the history there because I work at Harvard, and I know that there's been these waves of struggle, really good struggle by the dining hall workers. The minute that goes down, Harvard runs back in and tries to take away as much as they can from benefits and wages, and or keep wages stagnant, and then layoffs and all sorts of stuff. And then comes back. Then there's another round of struggle, and some things are won back. And this particular round of struggle, there were some things definitely won back. That was really good by the union at Harvard. And I think that inspired other places to organize and inspired more people going into that union, I believe. I don't have the facts in front of me, but I believe that's the case. So I'm looking right now at an article from the Boston Globe, the boss's glob, as we say here on Socialist Alternative Radio. From April 4th, Tufts Dining Hall workers announced they have unionized. Now, what that means is that it's really a lot of laws in the United States that prevent easy unionization or even difficult unionization, just prevent unionization at all. And that is this Byzantine process you have to go through to form a union. And if you go through the National Labor Relations Board, which most unions do, although you can force a company to recognize a union without doing that, but it's very difficult. It means probably going on strike and so on. But so a lot of you, and that's the way, you know, frankly, we prefer going about it. But most unions now will go through the National Labor Relations Board. So the first step is to get cards, they call them union cards, signed that say you want to be represented by a union. And with the atmosphere of terror and union busting that happens throughout the United States now against unionization attempts, like they'll hire these subcontractors or contractors that will come in. Their whole company is to stop union drives. That's it, you know, and their whole business is just doing that. And they bring in consultants that are making like huge amounts of money to motivate them to do this evil deed. And they go ahead and do this evil deed, and they do things like captive audience meetings where they force workers to go into meetings and hear anti-union propaganda. That's a bunch of lies. I mean, I've been through it many times, helping to organize unions and being in unions, and I've seen these captive audience meetings, and they are just lies. But who's there looking over their shoulder? The government? No. The National Labor Board is extremely weak and is extremely pro-business, even at times where labor leaders will defend it and say, we have a pretty good NLRB now. No. You look at the amount of time it takes for cases to go through. You look at the decisions being rendered. You look at just step back and look at the process. It's so stupid and time-consuming and engineered to help management delay, take any energy out of a union. The momentum comes from a union drive and an election. They call it an election for a union, and then to organize the first contract. See, what you have to do in the United States is, it's not good enough to have, like in this case, I think it's 75% of the workers have signed union cards saying they want a union here at Tufts among the dining hall workers. So that's not good enough. No, I'm going to check that stat in a minute, but I think that's correct. that's not good enough. You know, I mean, the company could recognize the union immediately, but they never do, almost never do, right? So they force to go to an NLRB determination election, which first thing is this long process of determining who should be in the bargaining unit, quote unquote. That's what they call it. That's what they call the union in a local area, in the workplace, certain workplace. So the NLRB, it's written into their law, the laws they go by, to split up that workforce as much as possible. Oh, supervisors can't be in the same union. People that work in human resources, because they have access to confidential information, supposedly, they can't be in the same union. So the company can claim these people are really supervisors when they're not. The company can claim these people do something very, very different and they shouldn't be in this union and all this kind of garbage, you know? And you have to go through all that garbage, the recognition hearing. That usually whittles down some of the strength and energy and people that you want to organize. Then you go through a process and you're going to have a vote. The NLRB will come in and do this vote in the workplace, but they'll set it, you know, a year from now, 2 years from now, 8 months, whatever. There's always a delay, so management can hire those consultants or on their own just create a huge atmosphere of terror and fear if they can. Workers are a lot stronger than we're giving credit for. And if that fear campaign can't be resisted, then you have union drives that sputter and fail, and you wonder why there's a close vote or why people vote against the union when 80% of them, 90, sign cards for the union. Well, that has actually happens, you know. The other thing that happens then, say you win the election, as they call it, you win the legal right to have the union through an NLRB process, through all that waste of time and everything. And then you have to organize a first contract. There's no law that says in the United States that this company must sign a contract with the union, believe it or not. There's only a law that says they must negotiate in good faith. And this is, of course, open to wide interpretation, what that means. And usually it means whatever the company wants it to mean, because the NLRB is pro-company all the time. Even when they rule against the company, it's sort of a little thing where they're saying, oh, in this case, we'll do this, but don't worry, big business, because we got your back 99% of the time. So that's what these workers are facing. And yet it's worth it if you can tough it out, if you're strong and you get that election done and you get that contract done, then your life changes, basically. That's what people don't understand about unions. Your life will change for the better. You will get, there's no such thing as a first union contract going backwards. You always gain something. And you know, there are certainly union leaders that unfortunately approach negotiating as a concessionary process. It's not so much in first contracts, although I've heard of that too, believe it or not, but mostly in subsequent contracts. So there are places where unions are moribund, where they're dead in the water, where the members don't even know they're in one, except that there's dues coming out of their paycheck. But there are, even in unions like that, it's better to have a union than not have a union. There's a possibility, it's very, very hard in some unions, but it's a possibility to reform a union and kick out a union leadership that's in bed with management, that believes in jointness with management, that believes in the team concept with management, all that kind of stuff. There are ways to kick those people out. It's very difficult in some big workplaces or big unions, but it can be done. It has been done. In fact, part of the teacher strikes, the success of the West Virginia teacher strike, and now in Kentucky, is to go around the union leadership, basically, where rank and file teachers using social media, using Facebook and so on, using a series of protests and getting to know each other, they were able to organize strongly enough within their own union to ignore the, as we used to call it, bovine conservatism of the union leadership that wants to do everything by the book, that wants to play by the laws of big business. And it's a failure. That fails. That's why they were down to, in West Virginia, there was a right to work state where they couldn't even legally bargain for a contract. So what the rank and file teachers did was they organized a strike. And the union leadership said, well, that's illegal. You can't go on strike. Well, no kidding, it's illegal. Every public sector strike that you can think of practically, I mean, the vast, vast majority of them are illegal based on state laws, teacher strikes included. And yet, anyone that's lived long enough in the United States is probably, that pays attention, has seen teachers go on strike, always illegal, or almost always illegal, you know? And they do it anyway, and they win. Now, at other times when the labor movement was stronger, big business didn't even bother saying, this is illegal, we're going to arrest you all. I mean, they might make a little threat, but, you know, it really wasn't very potent. Now, starting in like the 90s or late 80s into the 90s, the threats became real to a certain extent. So the teachers were really risking going out on strike illegally, which is what they did in West Virginia. But they had to, and they did, and they won. They won big. They won 5% increases for all state workers, not just teachers. They won better health care, and the health care was really, the concessions were really going after them. They were really, the state was really going after concessions in health care on the teachers, and they beat those back. And other things that they won as well, which we can get into later. But basically, the point is that it was all illegal, and it was all done by the rank and file. And there were points where the teachers' union leaders tried to stop things, and they were overruled by the members. Now, that doesn't happen a lot. A lot of times in unions, there's a unfortunate conservative attitude among members themselves that they're afraid to go against what the leaders say. Because that's the way the union has been set up. There's no education about your rights as an individual union member and as, you know, changing leadership and so on and so on. They make it seem like the union is the people in the union office, some of which are elected, some of which may not be, depending on what type of union it is. And that's very, very damaging. Very, very damaging to the labor movement to have, you know, unions like that where there's no voting on, I'm in one where there's no voting on contract provisions, no voting during negotiations. All you get to vote on is the final product, usually containing concessions, and you're told if you don't vote for this, you'll have to go on strike, and strikes are just horrible things. You never want to do that. You can't win a strike, blah, blah. This is the union leaders I'm talking about now giving you propaganda about that, like they're bosses. But they're not bosses. They can be voted out, a lot of them. They can be pressured. They can be, you know, you can have a union that the rank and file takes over, and that has happened de facto with the Virginia teachers and the West Virginia teachers and with other struggles. It's difficult, but there are times where you have more opportunities than others, where there's a mood in society where workers have been, are on, you know, on the offensive and fighting back, and you see more pressure from the so-called rank and file, from the union members, against the conservative policies of the labor leaders. And we're living in a time where we have been through a time where the labor leaders have been extremely conservative, so much so that they've destroyed the labor movement almost completely. And here it is out of the ashes, or the beginnings of the ashes, beginnings of the fire, burning it down, or whatever, however you want to continue that metaphor. There's hope now coming back from different struggles, and that will have an echo. And perhaps part of that echo is the Tufts dining hall workers. So here at Tufts, there was a rally with about 150 dining hall workers announcing that they had gotten enough cards to go to an election. The president of the union, Brian Lang, called on the Tufts administration, that's Tufts University, to recognize the union and immediately sit down to address the dining hall workers' concerns. More than 40 student groups have joined a coalition backing the union, and some 500 students marched with dining hall workers on Tuesday. 500 students, that's really good. That's from a Globe article. Going over to the student paper at Tufts very quickly, students and workers rally in support of dining hall workers. Also April, that's up from April 8th. Let's see if I can get that. Oh, yeah, here we go. Over 75% of workers, that's that quote I was looking for, have signed their union cards. And they're quoting a worker who says, "We will win." Or they're quoting a student, perhaps. Yeah. Again, this is great news. But signing the cards is the beginning of the battle. And I would just urge, on behalf of Socialist Alternative and other socialists and activists, I will take this sort of collective we here and just say, really urge the students to try to find a way to keep the pressure going over the summer. I know that's very difficult. Everyone scatters, but that's really, really important. And it's great. 500 students showed up. That's absolutely brilliant. Is there a way to keep that going over the summer? Is really, excuse me, really very important. You don't want to lose that 3-month period to Tufts just being able to try more intimidation and so on. In fact, some of the chants from the marchers led by student organizers were, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, intimidation has got to go. The students and the workers will never be defeated. Thanks for feeding us." That's a good one. I heard that one at Harvard. excuse me, student organizations and workers, again, over 40 student groups have a coalition statement. Part of it is, quote, maybe this is the whole thing. We students of Tufts University stand with the Tufts dining workers. We know that Tufts dining workers are the heart of this campus and have made it our home away from home. Tufts dining workers deserve a workplace with respect and dignity, free from discrimination and exploitation. We are united as a community in support of the workers' demands for a union. That is really good. That is really excellent. Again, a note of not caution, a note of like solidarity. How do we keep this going over the summer? Really, really important. And also how to, there's a certain amount of turnover, obviously, with students. How to resurrect the movement in the fall, late summer, early fall would be very, very important. By the way, anyone involved in the union drive listening to the show, if you want to come on the show, you're more than welcome. Just get in touch with, go to Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook and let us know. Just message us and we'll get you on. No problem. Say whatever you want. Good quote from the workers in this article. Quote, we're chefs. We spend $46,000 on culinary school. We want to show our creativity. We want to show you nice things we can do, but they won't let us, meaning management won't let us. This person, who is it? Who am I quoting here from this article? Christine Tringale. She's worked at Tufts Dining Services for the last 8 years. Says the managers do not have our back. They constantly hide our complaints. They choose favoritism, basically harassment. They constantly trying to push our buttons. It's not right. We've been here too long. We've got people here over 20 years. And they've seen some horrible things. We just want fairness. I don't know if you've ever, like, you know, been to college or been to a college dining hall thing. You often see that kind of heavy-handed management, you know. Really pathetic, like, you know, people that aren't making a lot of money, but they got that manager, you know, gleam in their eyes. And they're going around being cops for the larger management, harassing the workers and so on. It's very labor-intensive work. Universities, by the way, are trying to get out of that. They're trying to cut dining services around the country. And the students are probably going to put up with it because it's hard. While this is a great example of student solidarity with the workers, it's sometimes hard, especially at more expensive schools, to get students to pay attention to ways they're being screwed over. And it does happen, even if they're getting think they're on the track to getting this big degree or whatever, things could be a lot better. And oftentimes at schools, not even necessarily rich schools, things that are directly affecting students are the hardest things to get campaigns around, like tuition increases, you know, because, well,